We have a just a multifaceted reading from Mark's gospel. It's chapter 6, 1 through 29. I didn't put all of it because it's gigantic and involves a whole nother story about Herod being a paranoid, narcissistic, dirtbag king who offs people who annoy him, like John the Baptist. It didn't seem like it had anything to do with the world that's going on right now, so I didn't include it. But we do have much of chapter 6 of Mark, and it's about Jesus' return to his hometown. Nazareth is really small. Jesus' hometown was so small, I've mentioned this in classes and in sermons before, but it bears repeating. Nazareth was so small that they didn't find archaeological evidence of it existing until the mid-20th century. Back in the 19th century, cranky German scholars were thinking that Mark must have made it up. The gospel writers must have just invented it because they needed him to be from nowhere. But then in the mid-20th century, while they were excavating under the present Palestinian village called Nazareth, who knew, they found the ancient town of Nazareth. But we're talking about a dozen buildings. It's small. It makes West Danville, it makes South Walden look like a metropolis. It makes East Hardwick look like a metropolis. And Jesus must have been away for a while, because when he comes back, they hardly recognize him. And the story goes like this.
He left that place and came to his hometown, and his disciples followed him. On the Sabbath, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astounded. They said, "Where did this man get all this? What is the wisdom that has been given to him? What deeds of power are being done by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him. Then Jesus said to them, "Prophets are not without honor, except in their hometown, and among their own kin, and in their own house." And he could do no deed of power there, except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and cured them. And he was amazed at their unbelief.
Then he went about among the villages teaching. He called the 12 and began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over the unclean spirits. He ordered them to take nothing for their journey except a staff, no bread, no bag, no money in their belts, but to wear sandals and not to put on two tunics. He said to them, "Wherever you enter a house, stay there until you leave the place. If any place will not welcome you, they refuse to hear you. As you leave, shake off the dust that is on your feet as a testimony against them." So they went out and proclaimed that all should repent. They cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and cured them.
Nothing like a hometown, huh? Coming back to your hometown, hometown synagogue, hometown church when you've been away for a little bit, or even if you haven't, it's hard. Narda, can you talk about some of the ponderings you've had to have about being here?
Well, I started here when I was 10, and my parents decided to change churches. And I grew up with West Bristol and Gil Myers being very involved in the youth worship And then I became an adult, and I kept going to this church, and eventually started sitting on Pastor Parish Building Committee when we did the addition. Mm-hmm. And at multiple times, when we had meetings where things got very contentious, both of them said to me after the meetings that, you know, you're so smart, and I'm so glad you're on this committee, but I cannot look at you without seeing a 14-year-old girl. And, you know, so it was always, everyone always made me feel okay, but it took some getting used to when I found my voice. Mm-hmm. I want to know what Jeremy says.
We'll wait till you're not in the room. But you also made a really important decision for a time when you got remarried to be at another church, because it was you needed to have a place where you could really define who you were within a different context as a really different person.
And that was really different too, because people didn't know I had children. You know, they didn't know how old my kids were. They didn't know that my mother had been involved in the church. I had to really, I'm not sure I ever felt totally like the church I went to for 5 years was my family, but they embraced me, and I also felt much freer to express my opinions there.
Wait, really? Yep.
Nobody knew what I did when I was in college or in junior high, and I had a different perspective as an outsider, and I had nothing to lose. Right? And because I didn't know where other people, what they had done when they were younger, mm-hmm. maybe I was less afraid of offending people. Mm. Not always a good thing. Yeah.
Art, how about for you?
Oh. So I'm what, seventh, eighth generation? I can remember when we had Sunday school was around the stove downstairs, and sat these little wooden chairs all the way around. You know, I grew up coming through the church, did MYF, was Margaret Steger and I were great friends in MYF for several years. Trips. Just a warming family and everybody around me grew up with. Now I'm the chair of the trustees. Yeah.
was the transition from kid to adult a weird one for other people? I mean, were you allowed to be who you were?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I think so. And there was a period when after high school, I was in college and in my early 20s that I probably didn't attend on a regular basis.
Right.
I think a lot of people find that transition unique. They need to find their own place.
Sure.
And it's been fine coming back, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We just had several years, obviously. But, yeah.
Good. It can be tough. Sounds like this is not too hard a place for that to happen. For a lot of folk, going back to hometown is more difficult. It's been weird for me because I someone says, "So hometown," Charleston, South Carolina, Myrtle Beach, Guantanamo Bay, Newport, Rhode Island, Atsugi Naval Air Station, Menominee Rincon, New London Submarine Base, Gales Ferry, Waukegan, Illinois, Fox Lake, Illinois. That brings me to seventh grade. I'm not even sure I can name what a hometown is. But I remember in seminary, we were in Illinois visiting Barb's parents, and said, "Hey, come on up. I'll show you where I went to high school, up in Fox Lake, or actually unincorporated Ingleside." That's important to know. We get to the parking lot of Grant High School, and Barb said, I sat there shaking and sweating for 10 minutes before I was able to go into the building to go. It was summertime, and one of the faculty members that I got along with well was there. But I had some apparently unresolved issues. but I know it was four of the worst years of my life in that hometown of mine. That they had a language code. I think I shared this in a class. That they had a language code where they would give nicknames based on a two-part pun. I think Cockney slang is related. So my name is Mitch. So Mitch rhymes with pitch, and pitch is related to fork, and so my nickname was Fork. Hey, Fork, which is fine. That's fine. But the call you could hear in the hallway multiple times a day is, Fork is Enola. Think Enola, think of the plane that dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Enola, gay. Fork is Enola, Mitch is gay, which is the politer way that most people were usually calling me names, which was Mitch is the F word, you're an F word. That mental and physical abuse for 4 years was apparently all came out while I was in the parking lot that day. It was yucky. I just sat there and shook and sweat and finally got in, got to see Mr. Calabi, one of the administrators, and haven't been back since, have not been to a reunion. But I am Facebook friends with about four people who are human beings, so that's all good. When the good people in Nazareth heard that Jesus, their hometown boy, was going to be preaching in the synagogue, they at first reacted with that great aunt pinch the cheeks reaction. Ooh, how did he get so smart? He's so good. He's so powerful. Where did he get this stuff? There's also a version of this story in Luke, and it's very, very different. But the end result was the same. The reactions of the people start to turn darker. Think, wait a minute, this can't be happening. He's just a tecton was the Greek word. He's just a stone cutter. He's just a carpenter. The son of Mary and James and Joseph and Judas and Simon are not his sisters here with us? There's a subtle but important dig here. A man is always known in biblical terminology as name, son of, name of the father. They should have called him Yeshua ben Yosef, Jesus, son of Joseph. But they didn't. What did they call him? Isn't this the son of Mary? Isn't this the son of Mary? Joseph is not in the picture at all. They either don't know Joseph, or if they do know Joseph, it means they're suspicious about his actual lineage. Who was the father? Remember how scandalous that birth was in Matthew and Luke's gospel? Now, it's odd with Mark's gospel because there is no birth narrative, so we don't have any idea how people thought of an evening full of shepherds and angels and a birth with magi and stuff. Mark starts with John the Baptist. But here's the thing. The name Joseph never shows up in Mark's gospel. It's not even that he's invisible, he doesn't exist. Joseph, Jesus' dad, in Mark, in Matthew, and Luke, is not there. He either died long ago, or he hasn't been in the story. In any case, Mark is suggesting, or has the hometown people of his suggesting, that Jesus is a bastard in both senses of the word. Illegitimate, and who does he think he is? We know his sisters. We know his brothers. They're dirtbags just like we are. We're nobodies. They're nobodies. He's nobodies. They go from, oh, he's so cute, to who does he think he is? Mark puts it this way, and they took offense at him. That's in the New Revised Standard Version. There's a Message translation, or a Message paraphrase, and he puts it this way, Eugene Peterson. But in the next breath they were cutting him down, they tripped over what little they knew about him and fell sprawling. They tripped over what little they knew about him. Tripped is actually a really good translation, even though Eugene Peterson is a paraphrasist. That word tripped is a more literal word than the New RSV uses, which says they were scandalized or offended. Ready for a Greek word? At our interviews, interviewing pastoral candidates, this total aside has nothing to do with the sermon. One of my fellow clergy who were interviewing was upset that one of the candidates was using a lot of Greek terms in one of their exegetical papers. She's like, this is, I was like, what, that's fine. What's the matter with a little bit of Greek? And she said, it just means he's too lazy to use English. I was like, meh. I'm teaching you a Greek word. It's a good one, but you won't remember it. The word that gets translated offended is escandalizonto. Say it again with me. No, you're not going to. Wow. Escandalizonto, which comes from the noun scandalon, which sounds like what?
Scandalous.
Scandalous, precisely. A scandalon was a snare trap for a small game. It's the kind in the cartoons that people always got caught and hanging upside down from a tree in the cartoons. I've never seen one in real life. But a scandalon was a snare trap. If you tripped the bait or tripped the hidden trigger, you were trapped dangling in the air upside down. In this case, it gets translated as tripped or offended, scandalized. What caused the hometown folks to trip over Jesus? When they said, wait a minute, this guy can't be all great. He's just a carpenter, a tecton. Oh, another Greek word. You're right, I'm being lazy. I'm sorry. A person who works with their hands. How come he's acting so special? He's just one of those. He's one of us. He isn't anything. We know his family. They're schlubs just like us. Who does he think he is? The people tripped over their certainties, their comfortable old notions of who their little Jesus was. They tripped when their caricature of him didn't jibe with this new person of vision and love and healing and power and authority who has come suddenly into their midst. Even though they'd heard about this Jesus, they've heard the stories, they've experienced his wisdom, his authority, his love, his power, they tripped over what they thought they knew about this Jesus. They fell sprawling, and they never got any further. So then, Jesus, also a little offended, it sounds like, shares an old Hebrew proverb, a prophet is without honor in his hometown. And then Mark adds, again, I'm going to give the message paraphrase, Jesus wasn't able to do much of anything there. He laid hands on a few sick people and healed them. That's all. He couldn't get over their stubbornness. He left and made a circuit of the other villages teaching. Now, those nine words terrify my inner Baptist. Jesus wasn't able to do much of anything there. The more traditional translation reads, and he could do no deed of power there. Not he did no deed of power there. Not he didn't feel like doing a deed of power there. It says he could not do a deed of power there except laying his hands on a few sick people and healing them. He could do no deed of power there. Whoa! Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus the Christ, Jesus the Son of the living God who set the very cosmos in motion, could do no deed of power in his own hometown because of their stubbornness, their unbelief, their faithlessness. That terrifies me because it forces me to change the way I usually think about power. When I think of power, I go back to my aerospace engineering days. Power had a very specific definition. Power is the ability to do work over time. Work over time. Work is force times distance over time. More power, more work gets done. Whether it's accelerating your Dodge to extra legal speeds or launching a space shuttle to escape velocity, power is the ability to get things done. The political definition of power is also the ability to get things done. We have watched for 6 weeks the definition of political power used, abused, and misused. It's the ability to get things done, to have one's own will accomplished, even over and against somebody else's will. And whatever falls down, falls down. So in my traditional way of thinking, God is God because God has the power, right? By definition, God is the supreme being, the one of ultimate power, the one who blows galaxies out into space like dandelion seeds. God is God because God has more horsepower than anybody else. That works for you, all right? We all saw the Ten Commandments. We all saw Charlton Heston. Big special effects, big horsepower, big deity, cast of thousands. Moses raises up his arms, and what happens? Red Sea parts in Technicolor with amazing 1960s effects, the Red Sea parts clean as a bald man's comb over. God's enemies get pesky. God hits them with plagues, storms, disease, death of the firstborn. Ethics? We don't know. Justice? Not so sure. But power? God's got it in spades, man. So what's the deal in Mark's gospel when the Son of God comes to Nazareth and a few old homies decide that Jesus can't be such hot stuff because he's one of them, he's a loser like them, he's nobody like them, and Mark says Jesus could do no deed of power there. Now, if I had written the scripts, Jesus would have performed a couple of serious miracles there to knock the socks off these unbelieving rubes. Maybe thrown a curse on them involving fleas of 1,000 camels in their underwear or something. That's what I would write. Good thing I didn't. Jesus had his own script. And it turns my expectations upside down. It's a scary thing for a reasonably orthodox preacher to say out loud what Mark wrote, that Jesus could do no act of power within a faithless community. Can't God, by definition, do anything God chooses to do? Well, yeah. The question is, how does God choose to act in the world? And in Jesus' life and ministry, and in his death and resurrection, we start to get the message that the way God chooses to exercise power can look to human eyes a lot like powerlessness and vulnerability. And we who follow this Jesus need to learn to be comfortable with that. Or if not comfortable, at least being willing to not trip over it. It's a very different definition of divine power being shown in the ministry of Jesus than what we saw in a Charlton Heston movie. In Jesus, God's power is not exercised over and against others, but rather God works with and through those transformed and renewed people who say yes to what God is doing in the world. God works with and through those who say yes to love and mercy and compassion and justice. 2 Corinthians 12 reads, "My grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness." That won't work in Washington, D.C. Will it work in Essex, Vermont? In Jesus Christ, God seems less concerned about throwing around raw power than about coming into faithful, fruitful relationship with people who yearn to live and love and be made whole. In Jesus Christ, faith becomes a two-way street, a dialogue, an invitation, a mutual invitation to intimate relationship. It's a dance of mutual trust and mutual love and mutual vulnerability between the human and the divine. In everything he did and said, Jesus invites us to dance with this God whose transforming power is made perfect in weakness. If that sounds like a Zen koan, it's because it is just as mind-warpingly strange and wonderful. Here's the thing for us. If Mark says that Jesus could do no deeds of power in a faithless community, what does that mean for us as a faith community? Hoping to be faithful? It means we need to be faithful. A community who doesn't trip over our easy certainties and our caricatures of how God works in the world, who recognizes that God's strength is made perfect in our weakness. That's hard. I don't like being weak. I don't like being vulnerable. I like to be in control. Thank you very much. In the divine dance, I like to lead. I don't mind change as long as I'm in charge of it. And that opens up some big questions for a church, asking what it means to be faithful in the second decade of the 20th century. Is church about being a place where correct theology is taught? Or is it about creating people who are on fire for God? Is church about being a building that enshrines the architecture and mission of yesterday? Or is it about transforming living, loving people to be disciples for today and for tomorrow? One of the things we talked about during the interview process with our candidates, people who have literally been on these decade-long journeys and spending, there's tuition at seminary. They're tens of thousands of dollars in debt to get a connection to a denomination that in a month may not exist. And we have to ask them, are you stupid? What are you thinking? Is church about preachers with correct credentials, disseminating the right information? Or is it a people whose purpose is to glorify God, to enjoy God, to serve God, to love God with all their heart and minds and souls and strength and their neighbors as themselves? These are big questions that we have to wrestle with because we don't have the answers. No one knows how to be church in the 21st century because nobody's done it before. And the answers we've been wrestling with have gotten markedly different. And indeed, come February, when General Conference happens, we will very likely be turning into two or three new denominations. With two or three very different ideas about how God works in the world. We haven't had a conversation really yet about what's next after declaring ourselves to be a reconciling congregation. I mean, I have to admit, I worked so hard on helping us move toward that, getting the vote, and then patting ourselves on the back for being really, really progressive and wonderful and fabulous. And then some of you have said, fine, now what? Faster. Probably a better question is, so what? Faster. If we split into three flavors, this is a serious question, a serious discussion we're going to have. Which flavor do we do? I've had pastors go, I'm going wherever the retirement fund goes. Okay. I'm hoping the question's going to be, I'm going wherever God is moving in the world. I'm going wherever God is active in the world. I'm going wherever God's power is being shown in weakness and mutual vulnerability for the poor, for the oppressed, for those who are told they're not fully human, that they don't belong because they get called the F word or the N word, four words we are allowed to say out loud. Everyone here knows what it's like to be told you don't belong. It may not have happened in the church, and if so, bless you. But it may have happened in school, it may have happened in your own family, it may have happened in your community, it may have been among strangers. But you all know that steel ozone taste in the back of your mouth when you're told you don't belong. Here's what I think our lesson is from Nazareth. Our calling is not to trip over our certainties. Our calling is to welcome each one as a beloved child of God, even as we have been accepted as a beloved child of God. It means we're here to learn how to be disciples. Not disciples of an American Christianity that worships power and access to power, but a faith that worships a God whose power is made perfect in weakness. That's not nearly as comfortable. Andy Doyle wrote this about community. God is patient. God is at work. Even though he is rejected here, he is not fully without power to do miraculous things. God in Jesus continues to make his way to the ultimate rejection, and crucifixion. But it will be at the cross that he is victorious. God is at work in the world around us. God is at work whether we see it or do not see it. God is at work outside the walls of our churches and outside of our communities. In point of fact, some miraculous things are happening inside, but the great work is being done out in the world. The whole of creation is marching steadily toward fruition for the kingdom of God and his reign. It is at work, and miracles and works of power are being done by God through the power of the Holy Spirit as we speak. God is at work. The question is, are we going to go where God is working? Or do we stay with our arms crossed, stuck in our certainties, stuck in our comfortable orthodoxies, stuck in that's how we've always done it before? The lesson from Nazareth is we're called to be church. One more Greek lesson. Please don't throw anything at me. The Greek word translated church is ekklesia. It means the called out ones. Ekklesia is the called out ones. We get called in. We have a bell that gets rung, and we are here to hear a word of hope that can drive away our despair, a word of challenge that can send us, strengthen us, a word of grace that can bring us a deep sense of forgiveness and hope. But ultimately, we're called out because that's where God is doing God's work in the world. Right after this disaster in Nazareth, Jesus sends his disciples out. Two by two, just as they are. He said, don't bring an extra set of sandals. Don't bring an extra purse. Don't bring a walking stick. Just you. Just you. You are enough. I'm not strong enough. Nope. My power is made perfect in weakness. I'm not smart enough. All right. God's power is made perfect in our weakness. We're small. We don't have multiple staff. We don't have a million small groups. But God's love is made perfect in weakness. God's love is manifest in this vulnerable kid. You can't do much for anybody, can you? No. What are you good for? What are you good for, kid? You make dirty diapers. That's about it, right? You are no practical value to anybody. And yet you are where God's love is manifest, made real. We can see it in those beautiful blue eyes and the little gurgles. Yes! I'll pay you afterwards for the time. Do you remember scene where Jesus is taking children and picking them up? And his disciples are like, oh, no, no, leave Jesus alone. He's got important theology to do. He says, anyone who does not enter the kingdom as a child is not worthy. Suffer not the children, as they say in King James. Yeah. So as we're called out, it's more important to go out like this one and not like a president or a speaker of the house or a billionaire or a politician. Go as a child. Go as a disciple. Go as a beloved child of God.